till midnight doing some stuff. So it was like,
You ready? All right. House Committee on Revenue for March 9th, 2015 will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2067. And Mazin?
Yes, Chair Von Hartman and members of the committee, House Bill 2067 deals with one of our old favorites, the transient lodging tax. And in a nutshell, it clarifies that the intermediary facilitating the rent of a residential space is the one who is responsible to collect the tax. Just to give you a quick refresher on the taxation piece of the transient lodging, I put a couple documents in OLIS. One of them is the SMS, and the other one is the one that captures or republishes the parts of the statutes that have to do with the transient lodging taxes. The transient lodging tax on the state level was started in the year 2003 with House Bill 2267. At that time, it established a statewide transient lodging tax and fund to promote the tourism. And with that came an agreement of a preemption with the local governments. So the state tax of the 1% on transient lodging was accompanied with an agreement that there will be, and of course it's in the statute, that there will be no other taxes imposed on the local level except for ones that promote tourism at the 70% of what would be. Now, that bill was also expanded or clarified, and more definitions was put into the statutes in the 2005 session with House Bill 2197. It at that time we expanded the definition of what transient lodging to include the different units and exclude some of the other ones like the senior housing and drug rehabilitation units and so on, and included some of the conference halls, and excluded other ones such as the Boy Scouts and so on. So that was a more definitional type of work on House Bill 2197.
And what does this bill do?
And this bill, I think it does, it attempts to put into the segment of the statute that the transient lodging intermediary that collects or that does the web type of thing, or it doesn't have to be a web, but my expectation it is a web function for renting by individuals of their own space and houses, so it's a residential property, that they would be considered the ones to be the collector of the tax and the payer of that tax. And it is not what the last time of the 2013 House Bill 2656 done when it defined the intermediaries. So it's I guess it has that definition still in the definitional section of the law, but this one actually puts it within the tax collection section of the law, and it's not clear to me yet why, what the additional authority that would grant to.
All right. Thank you. I have two people signed up to testify on this bill, Bill Perry and Dan Jarman. They'll come forward. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill today? I note that there's nobody who's a proponent of the bill who's here, and we've just heard from Legislative Council I'm sorry, from the staff that they don't understand what this actually does. So if there is a proponent here who wants to speak, now would be a good time. Gentlemen.
Yep. No one knows really.
I'll go first. Okay, for the record, Bill Perry, the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association, chair members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity. I put on their neutral because I think what's trying to be accomplished with this bill, which is collecting taxes off short-term rentals, we agree with, but I don't think the bill is needed because I think the current statute already does that. I know one of the things up on the screen talked about the definitional changes or definitions in statute, and in the current statute for transient lodging, it says, and to quote, apartment units or dwelling units or portion of any dwelling units that are used for temporary human occupancy. So as it deals with short-term rentals or even a bedroom in your house, it's already included in the definition. Further down there, it talks about in section 14, a tax collector means either the transient lodging provider or the transient lodging intermediary. I can never pronounce that. So,
sorry, say it again.
In a minute, are you doing this to be mean to me? Intermediary.
Okay, thanks.
It also puts in there, if these definitions aren't clear on what the temporaries are, that the Department of Revenue has an ability to write rules around it. And then lastly, the current statute talks about the tax shall be collected by the transient lodging collector, which means either the provider or whoever's doing it. So what that means in all of this is whoever collects the money from the consumer is responsible for paying the tax. It doesn't matter if it's a OTC, a short-term rental company, or whoever the provider is. So no matter what it is, whether it's a hotel or in a bedroom in your house, the tax should be being paid. Now, I do think there's enforcement issues to where taxes are not being paid, but I'm a little hesitant to say we need this bill because that then says we don't think the current statute covers it, and I clearly think the current statute covers it. The question is, how do we enforce it is probably the bigger question. So with that, I will end and either answer questions or Mr. Jarman can go.
Please, go ahead, and then we'll ask questions for both of you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Dan Jarman, here today representing Airbnb. Airbnb is an online marketplace for people to list, discover, and book accommodations around the world, either through an online a portal like a computer or a mobile device. Airbnb has been around only since 2008, but it's a very popular web-based platform for doing short-term rentals. Airbnb is very proud to connect people around the world through this unique travel experience. We have more than 34,000 cities where people can book travel, 192 countries. That equates to 25 million guests over a course of a year, staying in a million-plus listings worldwide. Airbnb is just fine with this legislation. We believe Oregon is a very important marketplace for Airbnb, most evidenced by the recent work that Airbnb did with the city of Portland to legalize short-term rentals. We support the payment of state lodging, transient lodging taxes. Therefore, this is why Airbnb worked out an agreement with the Department of Revenue to collect and remit the lodging taxes on behalf of our hosts here in the state of Oregon. We're able to do this because we have a business model and a web-based platform that allows that facilitation of the collection and remittance of taxes. And again, we're very happy to do that. So we look forward to working with the committee if you choose to move this legislation, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative
Whitson. I was wondering if there are other computer programs or whatever you call it, like Airbnb, where they aren't registered with the cities, and I mean, I know there's something where you can go online and trade your house for a month or a week with someone else, and are there other programs that we aren't picking up revenue from? Anybody have any idea?
I'd be happy. For the record, Bill Perry, Chair was in, Chair Barnhart, or Rep was in, Chair Barnhart. Well, There are plenty of sites. You can get them off Craigslist, VRBO, Airbnb. You know, the difference is they're all a little bit different because some you just trade and there's no money changed hands, which there would be no tax. The others is like VRBO, I think, for sure. Don't quote me on this. All it is it sets up the communication. It says, you know, you're running your house. You can get it through my site, but you work out the deals on who gets paid. So to me, the question is, where is the money being collected? That's where they're all kind of different. If you pay on the website, then the website should be collecting the money. If you pay directly with, because most of, before a lot of these places existed, you know, like you go to Sun River and the realty companies do this service. Right. They almost always where it's the direct kind of local jurisdiction on the coast or in Sun River, those companies are collecting the money. But once again, all the law states is where the money's being paid is who's supposed to be collecting the taxes. And that's kind of where the differences are going to be, because you got Craigslist and a bunch of different companies that do this. Does that answer your question?
Pretty much. So we follow up.
Yes, please. Yeah.
We don't really know, other than the defined, you know, the hotels and motels and Airbnb, the ones that have agreements with the state, we just don't know what else is out there, basically, right? I mean,
yeah, once again, Representative Chair Barnhart, yeah, I would say that, because I mean, and the, Mr. Jarman can correct me if I'm wrong, even a lot of the ones that, in Portland, they still don't have a very high compliance rate. I mean, I don't think it's even close to 50. They can correct me. So, I mean, yeah, that's, you know, I think, you know, just personally what we would like to see is some sort of a registration process. I think anybody that is on one of these, you know, platforms that really promote things internationally, for lack of a better term, should be required to register with their city or local government, from my vantage point.
Thank you.
Thank you. I note that there's the, in the exception section that you've that the staff has given us, 320.308 indicates that if you rent your place for less than 30 days, the rule doesn't apply, and someone stays for longer than 30 days, the rule doesn't apply. So, in other words, you don't have to collect the tax if you rent your place for less than 30 days a year, and if you I think that's what this says. Maybe it doesn't say. A dwelling unit that is used by members of the general public for temporary human occupancy for fewer than 30 days per year. I think sort of a casual rental kind of thing. And then the other exception is a dwelling unit that's leased or otherwise occupied by the same person for a consecutive period of 30 days or more during the year. Also, as it fits the exceptions. But that doesn't apply to any of the things we're talking about, does it? Either one of those.
Chair Barnhart, well, I think there may be some people that rent out their house for less than 30 days, so they would be exempt. But like in the examples of Cannon Beach, Sun River, I think those are okay. More. But and if you're more than 30 days, you fall into the landlord-tenant obligation. So that's why it's. I think there's a whole different set of laws that occur in there. So that's why that 30 days is for 30 if you stay for more than 30 days.
Right. Thank you. Other questions for these two? Thank you very much. Is the department here? Do you want to talk about this bill a little bit? It looks like a compliance bill, but and I don't know exactly what. I'm not sure where the bill came from or what we have in mind for it. So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue, and I honestly don't know where the bill came from either. We are of the same opinion, I think, of the fellow down here, that the current law does, in fact, pick this up, this bill. In fact, we don't believe that this House Bill 2067 is necessary, and actually, as drafted, it could be harmful to the prior legislation in 2013 that was effective October 7th, 2013. Because it kind of brings into question whether this was the treatment prior or not. And we believe that it is the treatment as of October 7th. So we fear that if this were to pass, it would increase our litigation on a program that has got a severe limitation on funding. Additionally, there's some language issues within the bill that if it does move forward, we'd like to see made consistent with the prior 2656 and the language that's up on the screen over there on page 1 lines 15 through 17. We would like to see the words "and charge for" inserted after facilitate and before the words "the renting out," just to make it consistent with the other language. And then also, we think the word "personal" in line 16 is unnecessary because property is either residential or commercial. It doesn't need to have the extra word "personal" in there. So that's just confusing. So anyways, we do recommend that if this bill were to move forward, that it's made retroactive to October 7th, 2013, which was the day that the other legislation became law, and that the terminology is made consistent with current law. But otherwise, we don't know what it's trying to accomplish.
All right. You think that you have sufficient tools available now to require compliance?
Mr. Chair, we do, yes.
I mean, actually discovering and requiring compliance is a different problem, but in terms of actual enforcement, once you've made the discovery, that's, you have the tools to do
that. Yes, Mr. Chair, we do. We can do filing enforcement requests. We can issue deficiencies. We can collect on unpaid tax. And we have all those current authorities, yes.
And the person responsible is the person who collected the money from the short-term rental tenant.
Correct. Under the current law, this law, they there's no requirement that they also charge for the facility. They just have to facilitate it. And that's where the concern is. They aren't even handling the money, so why would they then turn it over to us?
Thank you. That's very helpful. Any other questions for the department? Thank you very much. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2067. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3032. These are separate bills, aren't they? You would like me to open both of them? All right. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3033 as well. And you're going to describe these for us. Yeah, good. Thank you. Yeah. All
right. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bills 3032 and 3033 are both relating to the administration of small estates. And 3032, what it would do is it would increase the limit on fair market value of an estate that may be administered as a small estate, and it increase it from $275,000 to $325,000. And the second change is increasing the limit on the value of the portion of the estate attributable to personal property from $75,000 to $125,000. And then House Bill 3033 would, under certain circumstances, would authorize affiants and claiming successors to execute instruments or documents of conveyance of real and personal property that is part of a small estate. And both of these, because they're relating to small estates, would not affect or have any implication on the estate tax. There are some fees associated with these, but that's about the extent of it.
Great, thank you. Representative, I think this is your first appearance before the Revenue Committee. Welcome.
It is, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is State Representative Mike Nierman. I'm from House District 23, which is the rural western Willamette Valley, and I'm happy to sponsor this bill and support this bill. I think it makes handling estates better, but we have more attorneys than we need in this room, and I'm going to let them talk about the bill. So.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, my name is Steve Monenbach. I'm an attorney from Dallas, Oregon. I'm on contract with the Department of Human Services. I do Medicaid recovery work. Someone who's on Medicaid and then passes away, oftentimes the family, because a Medicaid claim is in excess of the estate value, the families a lot of times don't open probates, and so then the department has attorneys on contract. I'm one of those attorneys, and then we go out and we open an estate, and then we dispose of the asset and then apply the money we receive against the Medicaid that was paid, so the money comes back to the state. And so I've been doing this for quite a few years for the Department of Human Services on contract. One of the problems that I've run into occasionally is in the small estate statute is the amount for personal property. So just to give you an example, right now it's at $75,000. And I had a lady come into my office recently, and she had her mother had an $80,000 bank account at Wells Fargo. And I had to open up a full probate. I had to published in the newspaper. I had to pay the $531 filing fee. I had to do accountings, affidavits of compliance, a final account. I had to do an enormous amount of paperwork. If the small estate limit for personal property had been what's being proposed, I could have just done a small estate, filed a small estate affidavit, and she'd have liquidated the funds, put it in an estate account, paid creditors, and distributed it. It would have cost a fraction of what it ultimately ended up costing. Contrast that with another estate I had recently where someone came in and they had $50,000 in the bank and a piece of real estate worth $180,000. I was able to do a small estate for them because I was under the $75,000 threshold for the cash and I was under the threshold for the real property. So I was able to administer their small estate for a fraction of what I did for the other estate, even though it was worth 2.5 times more money. So by raising the threshold from 75 up to a higher sum, it's actually going to save consumers a lot of money. And so that's kind of the gravamen of what I'm talking about with the raising the limit for the personal property. And on that issue, if anyone has any questions before I move on to the second bill.
He said before he moves on to the next bill, if you have any questions on this one, thank you. I was going to ask if you knew when these limits were, what year they were established, how long it's been?
The limits were raised, I think, I'm not 100% sure on this, but I think they were raised the session before last. The problem was that the personal property limit definitely needs to be higher. for the reasons I decided, because I continually have people come in and I ended up having to do a full probate and charging them all this money that I could have avoided if I just file a small estate affidavit, one piece of paper filed with the court as opposed to a lot of paper filed with the court. And filing fees are only $111 for a small estate. For just a regular estate like the one I described, it would have been $531. Then I have to pay the newspaper for publication fees, and I had to pay a final account fee of $268. So the cost of just the filing fees alone would probably exceed what the attorney's fees would be if I just filed a small estate.
So, follow up. So you believe these numbers were raised just one session ago, just in the last session?
I honestly don't know the answer to that question.
We're looking that up now.
Okay, great.
I had exactly the same question, and we're trying to find that out.
And then my secondary question is, particularly if that is the answer, is this sufficient? You know, is this sufficient to maintain if it does turn out that it was 2 years ago and now we're raising it again, is this sufficient? Did we just make this number up? Is it based on kind of here's the preponderance of the size of the estates we're dealing with and this seemed like a logical number, or is there a way we might want to index this to inflation? Where did it come from, and should we, if we're changing it every 2 years, should we index it or something to make it, I don't know.
Okay. So
you don't have to answer all of those.
Okay. But the one I will answer is I didn't ask for the upper limit to be increased. I only asked when I submitted this for the personal property limit to be increased because that's where I see the most problem. As far as indexing it, I don't know that indexing it is really the issue. I think the ratio of the personal property to real property has been the issue because more often than not, it's people that come in and they just have one liquid asset. It could be an annuity with a present value of $90,000, or it could be cash in a bank of $80,000, like the example I gave you. I haven't really run into the issue much with the real property valuation. So to me, it's not an indexing thing. It's just my own practical experience, and I've done dozens of these small estates around the state of Oregon. And that's the one I run into the most, is the personal property amount I think was too low. The overall amount and the real property amount hasn't been as big an issue. So I don't really think the indexing is as important as raising the amount of the personal property.
Thank you.
Representative Fitzit, please.
So this would benefit everyone, including heirs that are not then turning the money over to the state of Oregon. This would just be for everybody.
Yes.
So, okay.
Yes.
Great.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Vega Peterson, please.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to, not being a lawyer, just want to make sure I understand the reason for the difference in the having this actual category of estate is just because we're assuming that these estates have less complexity and therefore need less work on the, both on the state side and from the attorney to
yes.
do that.
And it's to simplify the process for families and reduce estate costs, expenses, having to hire an attorney. Some people do their own small estate affidavits. You can buy a Stevens Nest form, and some people do it themselves. Some people use attorneys, but it's significantly less money. And it just doesn't make sense to me if somebody dies with $80,000 to have to put them through a full probate, publish in the newspaper, and do all this and run the expenses through the ceiling. So it's, I think it's a good consumer bill. I think it would help people in general.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Representative Pence,
please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you share with the members of the committee the reason for the probate process?
That was my question.
Good question. The reason for the probate process would be an orderly distribution of a person's assets when they die. What happens is probate marshals together assets, disposes of assets, takes the money, and first pays creditors. There's a statute that lists out the priority of creditors, like the Department of Revenue, the IRS, funeral bills, medical bills. It has an orderly way of saying who gets paid first, and then if there's money left over, who receives the remaining amount. And who receives the remaining amount could be determined by a will, or if there is no will, by intestate succession. If it's by a will, if you say it all goes to a charity, the excess goes to a charity. If it's by intestate succession, then the closest next of kin blood relatives would receive whatever residue there is. But the probate code lays out a method of liquidating assets, paying creditors, and distributing what's left to family members or devisees under a will.
Does he pass?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so too. perhaps
you can mention the notice piece and then the piece about when there's unhappy folks among the family.
Okay, and I'm going to get into that a little bit under 3033, but what happens is when you do a small estate affidavit, what I was just discussing, you're required to send copies of that to heirs and devisees and to creditors. By law, you have to send a copy to the Department of Human Services in case the person had been receiving Medicaid assistance. If you do a full probate, you not only do that, do the mailing, but you also publish in the newspaper in the county in which the main assets are where the person died. So you give public notice to creditors. Creditors then have 4 months to step forward and make a claim in the estate. They have the same right in a small estate as they do in a full probate estate to step forward and make a claim in the estate.
Yeah, please.
And the notice piece, but the difference between the notices and the probate on the one hand and the small estate on the other, so
one
third party creditor.
The main difference is the notice in the newspaper.
Right. I think one of the things, and I'll get to you in just a second, I think one of the things we're at least that I am concerned about is how we justify a particular number. Obviously, the reason for having a small estate process is to streamline and simplify and deal with the probability that the small estate doesn't have the kind of complexity that a bigger estate might. The question is then, where do we? This bill is about where you draw the line. And I detect some puzzlement about why the line ought to be drawn in any particular place. Any hope you could give us for that might be useful, other than simply a couple of examples where somebody happened to be just over the line, because the example we're going to hear next session will be, well, gee, we had $130,000 in a bank account, and we'd like it to be raised to $150,000.
I'm not familiar with the legislative history of how the ratio was established between real property and personal property in the prior sessions of the legislature.
I think it's kind of an odd ratio where you can have a $200,000 piece of real property and $75,000 in personal property. Just from my experience in administering small estates, I found the biggest problem has been with the $75,000. It hasn't been with the value of the real property. So I guess I can't directly answer that because I'm not familiar with how those figures were originally established, the ratio between the two.
Great. Thank you. Did you have another question? Yes, Representative Whitson.
I was wondering what qualifies as Medicaid assistance? I'm not familiar with the different categories. Is that like a rest home or senior living center, or is that medical? What falls under that definition of Medicaid assistance?
If an individual, I'll just give you an example of a lady that I was assisting. She had about a $300,000 estate. She sold her house. She put the money in the bank. She gradually, over time, while she was in a care facility, drew the money down to $2,000. Once she got down to the point where she was at $2,000, she had to apply for Medicaid assistance through the state of Oregon. She was able to stay in the same facility, receive the same level of care, but now it was being paid by Medicaid because she had no money left. As she continued to be on Medicaid, the amount that the state paid for Medicaid assistance continued to go up. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, it's a little different where a person is, I was giving Representative Nierman an example before we came in here. There was an elderly man in the upper Siletz River that owned 300 acres of timberland and lived in a little hut in the middle of it and didn't want to go to a care facility but needed Medicaid assistance. He was not forced to sell his property. What happened was Medicaid, he didn't have $2,000 in cash. Medicaid let him go on assistance. He passed away. He had $200,000 that Medicaid had given him as like a credit card. When he passed away, then I was hired under my contract to probate his estate because he had no family. He had no wife. He had no children. I probated the estate, harvested some of the timber. We left a lot of it for an elk trail and for environmental reasons, harvested some of the timber, paid off the $200,000 back to the state, and then distributed the balance to his family, his nephews. And so in that particular case, that person, even though he was land rich, he was cash poor, he was able to get on Medicaid, receive assistance, but then when he passed away, his estate had a claim put in to the estate, and then the state was originally finally reimbursed the amount that they had paid for his care out of his assets.
Yes. If I could follow
please.
Up.
Please, yeah.
So in that case, the care was provided in his home?
Yes.
Okay, mm-hmm. Like a nurse or something came
yeah,
in?
Yeah, someone would come out and he had a medical card, he could get medical assistance, they'd come out and help him with cooking and help him with care and so forth, yeah.
Right. Other questions? Thank you. I think we probably have finished with that bill, I suspect, and you're probably ready to go on to the other one.
Yes.
Please.
Okay. So the other one, what I handed was a proposal.
That's 3033.
Yes.
Right? Yes.
District. Okay, we're on 3033. And I handed out what was an amendment, but I was told by Representative Nierman I did it wrong because what I put in brackets is what I actually wanted to add as an amendment to the form. So I apologize for that. So I'll give you another example of initially a lot of times when I do a Medicaid recovery probate, the only asset is a piece of real property.
Right.
And so this happened over in Baker County recently, Grant County recently, where I had a small estate. I opened it, and I'm ready to sell the property because the property is under the limit for the small estate amount for real estate. I'm ready to sell it, and I find a buyer, and the realtor, and I sign an earnest money agreement to sell the property to the buyer, and then I get to closing, and the title company calls up the heirs or the heir and says, we need you to sign this deed. And they'll say, well, if I don't get any money, Medicaid is owed more than what the property is worth, I'm not going to sign the deed. And so what happens then is
I'm in a situation where I can't close and give close the transaction and give clear title to the buyer and get title insurance. And so then what I have to do is I have to open up a full-blown probate estate because in a full-blown probate estate, the personal representative can sign a deed and he doesn't need the family to sign the deed, just the personal representative would sign it. So this has come up numerous times in the last few years for me where I'm right at the point where I'm ready to sell, and a family member says, unless I get money out of the deal, I'm not going to sign the deed. The current small estate statute requires the heirs or family members, if there's no will, heirs or devisees, if there is a will, to sign off on the deed. And if they refuse to do it, then I can't sell it through the small estate process. Then I convert it to a full-blown estate, and then I've got all of these expenses coming up that I otherwise wouldn't have, which means, in the end, I still sell the property because now I'm, as personal representative, can sign the deed by myself. But all those extra costs and attorney's fees are taken out of what I can reimburse to the state of Oregon as a Medicaid recovery. So what this bill would do would be it would give me authority as a small estate affiant or claiming successor to sign the deed without a recalcitrant family member saying, I'm not going to sign it because I don't get any money. Why should I sign it? And I had this happen over in Grant County recently where actually one of the heirs was living on the property and refused to leave. And I had to evict them, and they refused to sign the deed. Happened over in Baker County recently where I got to the point where I was ready to sell it, and the family members refused to sign the deed because they weren't getting any money. So then I had to convert it to a full estate, and that cost more money. This bill would allow a small estate affiant, if they're approved by DHS, and I'm one of the approved attorneys, if you're an attorney approved by Department of Human Services, you can sign the deed without an heir or claiming successor, and it would save, in my opinion, thousands of dollars in fees and costs for the state of Oregon that they're not receiving right now. And there's actually someone here, Rick Mills from the Department of Human Services, who could talk about the effect of this and how it really would help in terms of saving costs.
Rick, do you want to come up? We have an extra chair. Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. First, I apologize for my informal attire. When I woke up this morning, I didn't realize I was going to be here speaking to you folks about HB 3033. After this bill was introduced, I did have an occasion to speak with Mr. Monenbach about it and what the concept that I understood it to be and what he was trying to accomplish with this bill. I haven't had a chance to fully review the proposed amendment that he has here, which he gave to me just shortly before we came into the hearing room. But the concept that he's proposing, it would result in some additional revenue for the Department of Human Services Estate Recovery Program. Anything that we can do that minimizes the cost of probating the estate leaves more money in the estate, which is then available to pay creditors' claims, of which some of those are ours. And incidentally, we do estate recovery not just for Medicaid, but also for general assistance, Oregon Supplemental Income Program, and what we call the Medicare Part D clawback.
Okay. So let me start the questioning. My sense of what you've been describing are estates that are essentially underwater. The obligations of the estate exceed the estate's assets. And so any additional cost that is incurred in order to process that reduces the amount of money that the creditors will receive. That's essentially what we're talking about, isn't it?
That is correct.
Okay, I'm getting head nods. Thank you. Other questions? Let me, yes, Representative Bence, please.
Obviously, the balance is between situations where they're underwater and situations where they're not, and we're not sure that we're getting the truth of it from the affiant, whoever that might be. So that's the reason for the current limitation on how we do this and the reason for probates in general. So how do we make sure that we don't open the door to sales of property when whoever it is busily filing this affidavit chooses to lie?
So the amendment that I'm suggesting is it gives authority to an attorney approved by DHS to sign the deed if there's a recalcitrant family member who refuses to co-sign, which is what the current statute requires. So I don't think that would play under those facts, but I will address your first fact scenario. Even when there's money beyond what the creditors are owed, I've run into the problem where, say, I have five children and four of them sign the affiant's deed and one of them doesn't because he doesn't think he's getting enough money. And so then what I've got here is I've got a deed. I'm signing it as affiant claimant successor. I've got four heirs signing it. They're all going to get $5,000 apiece, and one of the five heirs refuses to sign because he doesn't think $5,000 is enough money, or that I didn't sell it for enough money, even though that's what the market was. And so then when he, and this actually happened once where I had three sisters ready to sign and two brothers that wouldn't sign. So what I had to do then was, and this was for property down in Lane County, I had to then close the small estate, open a full estate, sell it as personal representative. It took me another 9 months before I sold it. I got less money for it. And then I ended up paying the state, and they still got a little bit of money each. However, you have to deal with family members who, for one reason or another, don't like the sale price or don't like how it was sold. Already under the probate code, a personal representative, if I had just started those out as full-blown probates, which would have cost more money, I would have had the right as PR, personal representative, to sell the property with a personal representative's deed. All I'm doing is asking that you give the same authority if the person is an attorney approved by DHS to that attorney, because in the end, it's going to save a lot of money. In each one of these estates where I've had to convert it because I had someone that wouldn't go along with the sale, I ultimately sold the property. I did it as personal representative. I didn't involve them in the sale, and they didn't have to sign the deed. But then it cost a lot more money, and there was less money available to pay off creditors.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz. It's not always a case of, as you put it, an underwater situation. Sometimes what we run into are the nephew has been living with grandma. Grandma passes away. The house was owned, invested in grandma's name. The nephew has no incentive to leave the premises. And so in situations like that, it may not be an underwater situation. That is to say, the value of the real property may exceed our claim, but because the nephew has no incentive to have the property sold off and pay our claim, we will then nominate an attorney such as Mr. Marinenbach to open a small estate or a full probate. And so if the nephew is the heir and he's unwilling to cooperate, Mr. Marinenbach would ordinarily have to do a full probate, which increases the cost for everybody. So it actually harms the nephew as much as it harms us.
Follow up? Yes.
Right. So the issue is one of having all the appropriate tools available and making an appropriate assessment of the situation before you initiate the small estate proceeding or the probate. If you're going to have to throw somebody out, you're going to have to go to court anyway. So that your hypothetical, you're going to be in court anyway to get him out of the house. So I understand the balance extremely clearly because I've had situations where we've been asked to come in and unwind wrongful use of these small estate approaches by people who just aren't truthful. So I understand the balance between trying to avoid additional cost and the larger, it's more sure, more careful, more court-controlled probate proceeding. I get it. So I do agree with the chair that the question is, where do we draw that line? We're never going to get it right. So
can I address that, Representative Benz?
Yeah, please, go ahead.
So in terms of knowing in advance whether there's going to be cooperation between the heirs or not, I've had several where I've been told they're all cooperative, and then when it comes time to sell the property, they don't feel I'm getting enough money or some other reason, and so they say, we're not going to cooperate. All I'm saying is that if we amended it to give an attorney approved by DHS the same authority that a personal representative has under a regular probate, in my experience over the last 3 or 4 years, I've had this come up
four or five times, it would have saved thousands of dollars that I could have recouped for the state that I wasn't able to recoup, because then I had to convert it to a full probate. I'm just, so it's just that, just adding that part that I added on the proposed amendment would, in my opinion, save quite a bit of money, and it would only just be in that narrow exception where it's a small estate where the affiant or claimant successor is the designee of the Department of Human Services. It wouldn't be giving that authority to a claimant successor or affiant that's a family member or someone else to do it, because that could create issues. So I agree that could become an issue if it were someone like that.
Thank you, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for a fascinating discussion. I think that there are a couple things at play here. First of all, there is the numerical limit or the monetary limit that we're talking about. But in my estimation, in practice and interactions with the estate and trust bar, one of the key purposes of the small estate procedure is for uncontested estates. And a potential issue here, I think, is if we do have contests, and I understand the perspective that you're talking about in these situations are contests in which you clearly feel you're the winner. When we have contested cases, that is essentially the point historically of having a probate in which a judge is the arbiter of the decision. And in terms of cost, if we do have a small estate that's filed and someone who would contest is given notice, the burden is then upon them, is my understanding, to initiate a court filing and an estate and bear a substantial cost in doing so. And perhaps I'm wrong on that point, you could clarify. But I think there's some danger in allowing a small estate procedure to move forward in a contested case. Even if the contest seems rather frivolous, that is why, in fact, why we have a court system.
As a part of that question, a minute ago you said that this would give the same authority to the affiant as the personal representative would have if a regular estate was opened. That isn't really true, is it? Doesn't the court have to approve a sale by the personal representative, or can the personal representative simply do it without the court's approval?
The personal representative can do it without court approval unless the will provides that the decedent, unless the will provides that a particular person is supposed to receive the property. The property can be sold by a personal representative without court oversight.
Okay, thank you. And now back to his question, please.
Okay, so a will contest, when you say contested proceeding, I'm not sure what you mean by contested. If somebody's contesting the validity of a will, they have 4 months to contest it, and they would have the right, if it's attached to a small estate affidavit, to another probate and contest it. But if they wanted to do that, they could do that whether it was a regular estate or a small estate. Okay, but there's a 4 month period within which they would have to contest after they've been given notice of the will. Okay, so what I'm talking about more is you're getting a recalcitrant family member who thinks that either the personal representative or the small estate affiant isn't selling the property for enough money, and then they won't sign off on it, on the deed. I'm only talking about a very narrow situation where you have a small estate affidavit, an asset of real estate, and the claimant successor affiant is the designee of the Department of Human Services, that they would have the authority of a personal representative to sign the deed, so that we don't have one family member who messes up and doesn't allow the property to be sold by saying, I'm not going to sign that deed. I don't think you got enough money for it. If you were the personal representative, they wouldn't even have standing to come in and claim that. In a small estate, they can just refuse to sign the deed as an heir, and that messes up the deal. You won't be able to sell it, and then you're going to have to convert to a full estate in order to have authority to sell it. And this has happened, like I said, many times over the last few years when I've been doing these, and it's just cost a lot of money that I think was unnecessary.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. We appreciate your is there another question?
Yeah.
Briefly, if you could.
Do we have time?
Yeah, we have another public hearing to hold after this one.
Okay. I just was wondering, back to the Medicare and the claims on this by the state. When a senior signs up for these programs, do they actually understand that they are, is there a form that is clearly that they sign that says, I am, you know, putting my belongings as a lien against the money that...
On the application form, it says that they realize that a claim will be made against their estate for whatever the value is of the services they receive. And they acknowledge that in the application form. Yeah.
In all cases, then?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsett, we have a brochure that we hand out to people talking about the estate recovery program and how it operates. There's also disclosure statements in the application form about estate recovery. And we do encourage the field staff to verbally warn or tell people that there is an estate recovery program.
But they don't always sign something. Are you saying they don't always sign something saying that? You're saying they get a brochure or they're being told, but do they sign every time that they
Chair
receive
Barnhart,
something from a program?
Representative Whitsett, they have to sign the application. They have to electronically sign the application. They have to give a verbal acknowledgement that they've signed the application. That's part of the application process for the assistance programs.
Okay, I'm still trying to understand. On the application, does it say I relinquish my property basically at my death, or are you just saying it's the? You know, I want to know: do they clearly know and sign a statement that they are giving up their right for their heirs to have the property if they engage in certain of these programs?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsett, what happens is we inform them that according to state and federal law, when it's applicable, there will be an estate recovery claim asserted against the assets of their estate. And as I said, that disclosure statement is contained in the application forms.
That's a bit off of our topic today,
but
it's a very interesting question.
Right.
Yeah, and you might want to pursue it further offline. That would be great. Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 2032 and House Bill 2033? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2032 and 2033. Open a public hearing on House Bill, 3032 and 3033. I get the numbers wrong. Now we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3016. Who's on that? Christine? Okay. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3016 would modify provisions of the capital gain exemption, and this is for amounts received for sale of a manufactured dwelling park. So if the owner of a park has an appreciation in the value of the park during the time that they own it, and when they sell it, they would be exempt from capital gains on that sale. Both in personal income tax or corporate income tax, if they sold it to a particular type of organization. And so what this measure does is provides more specific language on parties to which the parks may be sold to qualify for the exemption from capital gains tax. Also, there are conforming changes throughout the measure. It also fills in an oversight from the last time that this issue came up last session, giving a 15-day period for tenants to organize to purchase the park in the case where financial information is not given. That brings that in line with the 15-day time period the tenants have to respond when financial information is provided to them by the park owner. And so the tenants have some time to respond to this notice by forming an association that would be formed for the purpose of purchasing the park. At that point, they could either form a corporate entity under ORS Chapter 60, 62, or 65 that would be legally capable of purchasing the property, or they could associate with a nonprofit corporation or housing authority that is legally capable of purchasing the property. This measure makes the language more explicit that nonprofit corporations or housing authorities are entities that could purchase the property and that the property would be eligible for an exemption from the tax on capital gains from that sale. There is a revenue impact statement of minimal and a fiscal impact statement of minimal on the measure.
Thank you. Mr. Van Landingham, I saw you sitting in the back there. I assumed that you were here for this one. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on this bill? You're the only one signed up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Van Landingham. I work as a legal aid lawyer in Lane County. I am here to speak on behalf and in favor of HB 3016. This is the Manufactured Housing Landlord-Tenant Coalition bill for this session. The coalition consists of residents of manufactured home parks, tenants, landlords, the people who own the parks, and other interest groups. It has had a consensus negotiated bill in every legislative session since 1997. So this is that bill for this session. We met 11 times between May and February of this year. Each meeting is about 3 hours. I am the electronic secretary, the primary tenant negotiator, the draftsperson, and the official splainer of the bill to legislators. There are some new faces here. So let me just explain that we're talking about people who own their manufactured homes but rent the land under the home. If you own both the home and the land, you are treated as real estate. These homes are personal property because they're on somebody else's land. If there are four or more spaces within 500 feet, it's considered a park and regulated by residential landlord-tenant law. In 2000, I'm only going to talk, I hope, about, and I should say I know nothing about probate. I'm only going to talk about the revenue issue that is in this bill, because I think that's why the bill is before you. My understanding from the speaker's staff is that the bill will then go to House Human Services and Housing to talk about the rest of the bill, because there are other issues in the bill. I've submitted a four-page explanation summary of the whole bill, and I would certainly be glad at your if you request it to go over the whole bill, although you don't have the amendments in front of you. I don't have the amendments yet, so I haven't seen them yet.
Yes, I believe that this bill only deals with technical issues and the tax issue as it stands today. If it's the committee's pleasure to move the bill to the other committee, then the other committee can consider amendments that would deal with the other aspects that you're talking about. Please do not burden the Revenue Committee with those.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree. So the background for this property tax, this capital gains exemption, is this. In 2004 and 2005, there was something we've called the park closure crisis, especially in red-hot markets around the Portland area, Bend, somewhat on the coast. Property developers were throwing buckets of money, cold calls, to manufactured home park owners because they tend to be large. One of them was in Representative Davis's district, the Thunderbird Park in Wilsonville. They tend to be large, flat, minimally developed, and built on the edges of urban growth boundaries and prime targets for redevelopment with more higher-end housing. When those parks closed, when they were sold, they typically closed and the residents were displaced. Their homes are not movable, economically or practically in many cases, and so a lot of people were displaced. Yeah. Late in the 2005 session, Representative Jerry Crummell suggested a couple of ideas to try to address that situation. And one of those was and is a capital gains exemption for park owners who sell their parks to the residents so that the residents can own them. We have statutes that you all have passed over the last several years to create cooperatives of resident ownership to nonprofits or to housing authorities. And the theory is that those three entities will maintain the park as affordable housing. Manufactured housing parks are the largest privately owned source of affordable housing in the country. Two examples, both unfortunately in Representative Barnhart's district, I think, are St. Vincent de Paul has acquired a park in Oak Ridge and maintains that as affordable housing. Mm-hmm. CASA of Oregon, which is a nonprofit that assists residents who want to buy their parks, help the residents up the McKinsey River buy their park. In both cases, in these cases.
Whereabouts on the McKinsey?
I think it's in McKinsey Bridge or Blue River. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Is that beyond your district?
Both of those are in District 7.
Ah, sorry.
Not my district.
Okay. Sorry, Mr. Chair. The capital gains exemption is important in these situations. This was adopted in 2005. In 2007, the legislature revised it and imposed a sunset of 2014. In 2013, you all extended that sunset to 2020. Okay, that's what it should still be. In 2014, the last legislative session, a group of us, the same players, brought to you a bill that we call the Opportunity to Purchase Bill. It was negotiated in a work group led by Representative Wisnett and Representative Nathanson. That bill created a procedure for landlords to notify residents and give the residents an opportunity to try to purchase the park. Inadvertently, that bill amended an existing statute and basically made this exemption no longer effective. It's still on the books, but it doesn't work. The reason it doesn't work is that the exemption refers to a particular statute and defines the parties that qualify for sales that qualify for the exemption. The Opportunity to Purchase Bill in 2014 amended that particular statute to only apply to marinas. Marinas do not qualify for the exemption. So we essentially have an exemption that cannot be used, and it doesn't help park residents or park landlords, and it doesn't fulfill its purpose. What we're doing here is fixing that so that it does the intended purpose. That's it. So this is not a new exemption. We're not expanding it. We're not increasing it. We're simply fixing it. Since January 1 of this year, that exemption has not been available to do the purpose for which the legislature adopted it. We want to reinstate that. This is supported by tenants, by landlords, and by other interest groups. I would note that there are two landlord groups in the state. One, Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, led by Chuck Carpenter. I believe you have a letter from Chuck Carpenter saying that he supports this. The other group is the Oregon Alliance of Park Owners. They are represented by Richard Kosasan, who's been in and out of the room, but he knows what we're doing. And I believe, after talking to their lawyer last week, that OAPA will at least be neutral on the bill. So I don't believe there's any opposition. Also in the room, General Ingram, on behalf of the manufacturers of manufactured housing, and she supports the bill. There are other things in the bill which I could talk about, but I hope the chair is right that that's all you want to do is talk about this.
Well, I think the things that are in the bill now refer completely to this tax issue and to the sunset issue. I don't think any of them are on the other issues that you hope to take up with the Human Services and Housing Committee.
Mr. Chair, actually, there in the current bill, right, as printed, are three fixes to what we did in 2014.
Okay.
One of them is this capital gains exemption fix. The other two are more mundane and have to do with the opportunity to purchase and not revenue.
Let me ask you the question I've been thinking about since we started. When I look at these mobile home parks, we're talking about facilities that have been around for a long time mostly. And in my district, at least, not the ones you referred to, but others, they're old. The housing in them tends to be old, not always, but tends to be. They're mostly rural, but some of them are more on the edge of the urban area. My suspicion is that with depreciation and other tax write-offs, the basis in the park by the owner is very nominal, or maybe non-existent. So when they sell, the big cost for the owner is the capital gains tax. What this bill does, as I understand it, is that we can't forgive the federal capital gains tax, but we can forgive the state capital gains tax, assuming that an owner is in the 9% or 9.9% bracket, we can save them 10%. In your experience, does this have the effect of increasing the attractiveness of an offer made by the tenant association to the landlord, because the landlord knows that he is actually going to pay less in taxes for the transaction? Or do you think it does not have that result?
Mr. Chair, I should note that I flunked tax law in law school. I didn't need the credits, thankfully. So I'm not the right person to talk to you about tax law. But, yes, that's our intent here, is to encourage park owners to sell the parks to the residents. And the residents are able to say to the park owner, we may not be able to offer you as much as a private developer, but when you factor in the capital gains exemption that you will get by selling to us, it's a better deal for you. And our experience is that's a significant part of our effort to preserve parks.
And that accounts, I assume, for at least part of the reason why both the tenants and the Landlords Association are supportive.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
In part, at least.
Yes.
All right. Representative Langer, please.
Well, thanks for coming here today, and it's great to see you. I want to say, one, that I think this work that you're doing to help transfer manufactured home parks to tenant cooperatives or tenant groups when possible with a willing buyer, willing seller arrangement is really important, because preserving that supply of affordable housing is crucial to having there be affordable housing in a wide variety of parts in the state, and it's way less expensive than building new affordable housing, although the wonderful stuff that was built in Wilsonville is a lovely testament to things that can be done when folks are displaced. But can you help me in the capital gains exemption part makes sense to me, but I'm trying to make sure I understand correctly what the financial impact is on the state. And it looks like under both fiscal impact and revenue impact, it says, well, I guess under one, it's minimal. What do we think that the effect will be? Do we have a prediction?
That's a Christina question, yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leininger, my reading of the measure is that it really clarifies language about who one could sell to and benefit from this tax exemption, and therefore wouldn't change the eligibility substantially unless there was a challenge to it, and that the language came into question. It's a little bit more vague in as it is currently, and this measure would make it a lot more explicit that this could be sold to a nonprofit housing entity, and that would be a subset of the people receiving the exemption as it is.
I see. May I ask a follow-up?
Please, yes.
So it sounds like by clarifying, it's not making a give that hasn't already been given, but it's clarifying the parameters of how it works. So within that framework, I think that makes a lot of sense, and am very supportive of this effort.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions? Representative Benz, please.
So line 10, page 1, an entity formed by the tenants of the park. I just want to make sure the intent of what we're doing up here is clear. That means an entity held, not only formed, but held by the tenants of the park. It wasn't formed by the tenants and sold to somebody else, and then they enjoy the tax. I mean, that's not the intent of this bill. I just want to make sure the record's clear on that.
Chair Barnhart and Representative Benz, that's referring to the opportunity to purchase statute HB 4038, which passed last session, and it defines the fact that the tenants are required, in order to compete to purchase, they're required to form an association. They're referred, and is that entity that they are, that's being referred to there.
I might follow up.
Please, yeah.
So the idea is, sure, they form it, then they sell it to somebody else who then utilize, because it was formed by the tenants, that's not enough. The tenants actually have to own it. That's the point.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, that's correct.
Thank you.
Yeah, and that's in the other statute.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. Is there any, I've already asked if someone else wants to be heard today. It's my intent to open a work session and send this bill to the other committee, if the committee is ready to do that. If not, we can hold it over. I'm getting some head nods. Thank you very much.
We'll
close the public hearing on House Bill 3016 and open a work session on House Bill 3016. Colleagues, the point of this of the request. On this bill, it's a very unusual request, because usually bills come to us from other committees. In this case, another committee wants this bill, I think because of the relating clause, because they have a bunch of other things they'd like to do with it. We needed to vet it first for the tax issue, which is, I think, fairly simple and one that we thought we'd already dealt with. But I think the referral the other direction is perfectly appropriate. Is that something you're willing to move,
sure.
Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3016 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and request the bill be referred to the Committee on Human Services and Housing.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the request that the bill be referred to the Committee on Human Services and Housing. Discussion. Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. With that, we'll close the works. We don't have to carry it because we're not going to carry it. We're going to send it to the other committee. So we'll close the work session on House Bill 3016. Paul, anything else for today? See you all tomorrow at 1 o'clock. With that, the committee's adjourned. Thank you.